Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 122, Stephen McLaughlin and Flames of War. So for all of you longtime listeners, you have already probably heard our featured guest when he was on way back in the Dark Ages on episode 50. But for you new time listeners, you're in for an extra special treat because not only is Stephen back on the show, which I am very excited about, but it's the first time I get to speak with him for the podcast. So I'm really looking forward to this. So, of course, our special guest is Stephen McLaughlin. He is the head honcho and founder of the WWPD Network, including a variety of podcasts, blogs, and all sorts of fantastic content. And for a brief stint, he was also an employee of Battlefront, the makers of Flames of War. So without further ado, I want to welcome our special guest, Stephen. How are you tonight?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you for that nice intro. Made me sound a lot cooler than I really am.
I don't know about that. I've had the pleasure of kind of following what you've been doing over the years since. That sounds really stalkerish, doesn't it? But
no, it's true though, right? We kind of, you know, everything was kind of going on all at the same time way back when. So it is true.
Like, I remember when WWPD started, it being just so excited about the enthusiasm that you brought to Flames of War that you made me excited about it. And I am a non-Flames of War kind of person. But like, you may be like, well, maybe someday I could, because it sounds really cool the way they talk about it over at WWPD. So I should think about this. And then, of course, there's that episode 50, way back when this show was under a different name. And you recorded with a former co-host of mine, Tom Barbalay. You guys had quite an interesting and varied discussion about all sorts of stuff. I'm sure you have no memory of what you talked about, but don't worry, because I have notes.
Yeah, I have absolutely no memory of that, so this will be fun. But yeah, you know, we really try to bring excitement and positivity to everything, and part of that was a backlash to when I started WWPD back in the day. Was I just felt like everything was so negative. It's like, you know, this is a hobby that we do for fun, and you know, forums are just rife with people just complaining about everything. Sometimes we tend to devolve into that because we're gamers too. And so, you know, once in a while you have to take a step back and be like, no, this is awesome. Like the fact that we live lives that allow us to do these fun things and not only do these fun things, but talk about these fun things ad nauseum. Like, you know, we should be really blessed and everyone should be really excited about stuff. And you know, not to say that no one should ever have any constructive criticism, of course, but I don't know. It just seems like sometimes people act like the world is falling or the sky is falling every single time something changes or their precious is affected, you know?
You know, some things never change. Like, I remember way back in the day when I was playing a bunch of the Games Workshop games, and like a new edition would come out or a new codex, and people were like, oh, did you see they changed this and such is broken, but now I can't do this, and I have to. Like, they'd freak out, and I think, whatever happened to just, like, loving the game and loving what you do? And if that's not working for you, then try something else that might work for you.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, kings in the Middle Ages, you know, a minor rules tweak to chess or something, you know, forsooth, the pawns shouldn't be this powerful. Look at them. They're the rabble, you know, I don't know.
Can you just picture the king's face who paid all that money for a brand new castle, and then the first time cannon came out, and he's like, oh, shit. There that right. Goes. Thanks a lot.
That's not fair.
No.
That's right.
If only I listened. Those newfangled devices.
Exactly. Right? We would keep them in check. Anyways, I think you were asking a question and I cut you off.
No. Well, so like on my, whenever I have someone on, I try to do like lots of preparation and I usually figure it's better for me to have more material rather than less. I like to have stuff left over. But then after I did all my prep, I was like, you know, I should probably go back in time and listen to that episode 50 and just kind of refresh my mind about what you had talked about then and see if anything kind of struck out at me. So I'm listening on my way home and then I get home and I'm scribbling all these notes. So I have like two pages of things just kind of, and this isn't even like the cool stuff that I want to talk about because there's like much cooler things in here. And as you know, you're not supposed to bury your lead, right? You're supposed to start off with what's amazing and you can hook your people. But
that's right.
I have to start off with something you said, and I made sure to get a quote on this because I thought this was really interesting.
Oh, no.
So near the end of that episode 50, you were speaking with Tom, and you guys happened to talk about an individual who works for a, or worked rather for a software company who made a trip to New Zealand. And when the topic of New Zealand came up, you said that your thoughts on it was that it, quote, mostly had sheep, unquote. So yeah. You had lived there at one point when you got hired for Battlefront, and I'm jumping around a little, but is it true? Is it a land of mostly sheep?
Can confirm. There's a whole lot of sheep. I think sheep outnumber people something like 3 or 4 to 1, but, you know, you can Wikipedia that and find out how incorrect that is. But yeah, there's a lot of sheep. I mean, you know, obviously I lived in the city, so you don't see a whole lot of city sheep. They're not quite as sought after. City sheep don't have quite the same flavor. But as soon as you drive anywhere out of the city, it's just, yeah, there's sheep everywhere. Pretty interesting, actually. We went to see Hobbiton, and it's mostly just sheep. And here's an interesting tidbit for you Lord of the Rings fans. Apparently, they actually, despite having tons of sheep at their disposal, all the sheep seen in both The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy were actually flown in because they weren't the right breed. They decided that the sheep that were here in New Zealand were too modern of a breed. So there you go.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, Hobbiton was originally a sheep farm. So basically just a section had been cordoned off, and then there's nothing but sheep everywhere else. So it's like little hobbit holes and then a sea of sheep.
I bet little did you know when you first talked about all the sheep in New Zealand that someday you would actually be up close and personal with them.
That's right. Well, I wasn't that up close and personal. I don't know what rumors you've heard.
Well, all those After Hours episodes, I mean.
Right.
So let's talk about WWPD. You've already covered numerous times, of course, on your own show and when you were on before, like the history of it and what got you into it and everything. Since then and these years past, what's been going on? What are the cool new things that you guys are working on? You have all these different sites and you're not just focused on Flames of War anymore. You have all these different games that you kind of attack and cover. So what's the 411?
Sure. Well, I mean, since I've been back, it's been a lot more about consolidation. So we haven't done a whole lot of expansion, and we probably won't for the time being. I've done a lot of work behind the scenes to get my head back around things like, you know, who exactly is WWPD in terms of like personnel, like is it our contributors or is it our staff? And what's the difference between a contributor and a staff member? So I've been doing just a lot of, you know, kind of housekeeping maintenance type stuff. We keep a network drive, basically a network share for everybody. You know, there's a section for contributors and a section for staff. And so I've been kind of trying to keep up our organizational knowledge so that if we onboard a new writer, like if someone says, hey, I'd really like to write a tactics article for Flames War, we can say, okay, great. Well, we'll figure out how to get that hooked up. Like now we have a style guide and, you know, exactly how to get ramped up and documentation of our process. Part of that is just the nature of both John and I's day jobs, right? We kind of do these things somewhat professionally. So I've been doing that a lot behind the scenes. Besides that, I mean, right now, it's kind of just, like I said, transitioning back to me being back and getting everything ramped up. So I've brought the main site back to five posts a week. I was dipping there for a bit because, you know, I'm a pretty big content generator. So that's been a big success. The last couple weeks have been really successful for us, which is really exciting. Besides that, we're working on upping up the game with the live shows. I think our last turnout was the best we've had yet at Historicon, which was really exciting. I mean, completely, every seat was full and there was not even much standing room left, which is really, really, exciting for us. And I think I've said it before, but it's just like a real affirmation to, you know, see that we reach people in ways that we want to reach people, or maybe in ways that we don't want to reach people and people are there secretly hoping that we, you know, fail and they can throw tomatoes at us. But I don't think anyone's quite that malicious.
Well, with the price of getting into Historicon, I would presume that, you know, there are other things they'd rather do than carry around a bunch of tomatoes to throw at you people.
Yeah, I guess that's why. Maybe that's why. Yeah, yeah, you're right. I was wondering where all the tomatoes were. I mean, I'm sorry if you hear the dog walking around there. She's trying to find a comfortable spot.
When the last time I had Jasper Ortiz on, it was really interesting because we were recording, and then out of nowhere comes Jack. And Jack, for people who aren't familiar, he is a proud member of the Karen Sowery Press staff there, where he makes sure all the papers that need to be shredded are shredded appropriately.
Yep.
So, like, he came on, he made an appearance, which was really interesting. And way, way back in the day, of course, before my wife and I bought our house and we have, like, this actual office that I used as a studio, I used to record right next to where our bunnies live. So you'd hear them all the time. So it's interesting the way people's pets interact with their hobby.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Usually it's not in a positive way, though, right? It's, you know, oh my gosh, you ate my tiger tank or whatever, but Maisie's been pretty good so far. Speaking of Jasper, we gotta get some beef going, I think. I've been trying to think of how I can call them out, and hopefully something will come to me, but I'm trying to start like a 90s rap feud with Jasper, on your show.
Are you gonna be East or West Coast?
Well, that's a great question, right? I mean, I guess we're more West than he is, so I'll take West Side.
Okay.
So that's it, Jasper. I'm throwing down, man. The gloves are off. I'm not sure what we're fighting about, but I feel like we really could use some beef. I think the gaming world would really benefit from some awesome beef going on. You know, people can take sides. It's going to be awesome.
Well, you know, sheep could be a suitable reason to fight. Not enough sheep or the wrong type of sheep.
Sure. Let's do it. I'm going to have to research those Netherlands sheep and find something to hate about them.
They're just not old enough for our film, so we need
that's
to get
right.
other ones.
They don't work, Jasper. Your sheep just don't work. They're dreadful. They're
all sheep. How dare they?
We're off. All right, let's move on to something besides sheep. What else you got for me?
Okay, let's talk about Battlefront. Because
sure.
At the time, I remember seeing online that you're like, oh, I'm leaving WWPD. I got this awesome opportunity. And you went there. And as I recall, you were digital content manager or something like that. And then you were there for a while. And for one reason or another, you returned to the States, and I'm not going to – your reasons for leaving are your own. I'm not – that's no one's business. But why don't you talk about your time there and, like, what it was like to be hired by them and, like, the whole process for that?
Sure. Well, it was pretty interesting, actually. And yeah, my title kind of changed a couple of times, but more or less I was doing, you know, digital marketing type stuff. But everyone there wears a lot of different hats, and everyone kind of pitches in together. So – when I first got there, it was interesting just to become immersed in the process, which is really pretty interesting. And it does give you a whole new appreciation for, you know, what we as consumers see, you know, as the end result, which are, you know, the tanks and the books, because, a whole lot of people work on those things. I mean, they have 3 graphic designers, they have 3 writers, you know, they've got a studio project manager, they've got a web team. They've got customer service people there, and then they've got a ton of very dedicated playtesters. And you know, one thing people should remember is that, you know, playtesters do it all just for the love of the game, really. I mean, they get, you know, a couple little bonuses here and there, maybe, you know, every new book and stuff. But what shows through in that is everyone's absolute passion about the hobby, and it's all feeding into this in a controlled way, which is really pretty cool, actually. I mean, you know, everyone kind of funnels, their own creativity into this, you know, big group pot. And sometimes people argue and sometimes everyone agrees and holds hands. And at the end of the day, a product that people are very proud of comes out. So it's really interesting to just, I guess, have that human spin to it. Cause a lot of people at the end pick up a book, look at it, maybe see a typo, maybe see a points value that's wrong and think, ah, this is terrible. But a lot of hard work and a lot of good thought went into that stuff. And it's for people who really love the hobby. So it was really exciting to be surrounded by people like that.
You mentioned the hobby and how people who love the hobby. At one point, Battlefront came under a lot of flack for returning to it as like the Flames of War hobby, the Battlefront hobby. And like the historical wargaming community was like, that's not the hobby. It'd be like Games Workshop saying it's a Games Workshop hobby. Obviously, from being on both sides of the fence, your perspective is unique on that matter. And what was your take on it?
Yeah, well, and I'll choose my words carefully here, but I'm going to say this about that. I would never attribute to malice that which can be attributed to poor communication. So I really think that was, I don't think anyone meant much by that. I think whoever wrote it that day had just said, oh yeah, this is the Flames War hobby, cool. And then probably was really surprised to wake up the next morning and see the forums on fire. That's my take on it, and I certainly wasn't directed any other way, nor was that term ever thrown around while I was there. So I don't actually know what went on there, but I suspect that it was just kind of a random occurrence that really randomly stuck for people. And I mean, yeah, I don't like the term either, and I didn't like the term when I first read it, and I still don't. So I think that, you know, these are small companies, right? This is basically a cottage industry. I mean, Battlefront's big for gaming, but it's tiny for companies. I mean, it's still a very small company. I think just not having a dedicated PR team, you know, whoever feels like writing it that day probably wrote that, and up it went to the website without really being vetted. And that's not a criticism of them. I think that's the nature of the beast. I don't think you'll see many other companies in this space, in this industry, that really have the capacity for that kind of stuff, right? I mean, Sears doesn't make a comment without having a team of people, you know, think through the wording and everything. Whereas Battlefront, half the time it's one person who's just, eh, we're going to talk about this hobby. What should I call it? Oh, I'll just call it the Flames of War hobby. Okay, cool, done. I really don't think there was anything more implied there. And if there was, I didn't hear anything about that or you know, learn about that strategy, which does seem to have been completely abandoned.
Well, I think it's tough because you raise a valid point. And not just for a corporation like Battlefront. They're like you said, they're a big company when it comes to gaming. But in the world, they're relatively small. But when it comes to, say, even like podcasters like you and I, we have to do everything. Like if I'm coming up with a press release, so to speak, I don't have like a PR guy. I am the PR guy. And like if you're like, oh, we're going to do this new endeavor, you don't have a test group to do whatever. You might have some people who volunteer or whatever, but like you guys are the ones who make the decisions. It's not like there's all these people just doing all this stuff for you.
Right. That's right. And it's easy for people, you know, I often call that, right, the armchair general or armchair quarterback. Mm-hmm. It's easy for people to stand back and say, oh, well, they should have said this and they should have done this. It's like, yeah, but all those guys are also stretched thin. I mean, that one guy isn't saying, I'm going to take the next 4 hours, you know, as a thought exercise to think about this press release. It's no, I've got 15 other things due today. So I've got to get this thing done. So I'm going to go write this and send it off to the web team and, you know, be done with that. I really just think it was just one of those things. And, you know, we've certainly been in hot water before too. And, you know, sometimes at the end of the day, you're like, gosh, did I really say that? It wasn't even really thinking about it like that. And, you know, but on the other hand, when you have hundreds, thousands of customers and a lot of those people are hooked, right? I mean, people get like you're probably, I don't know, you have a couple of Toshiba products in your household. What do you know about Toshiba? Do you go check Toshiba's website every week? No, because it's not a passionate thing for you. You know, hobbying is. And so and that means it really comes under intense scrutiny. I mean, everything comes under such scrutiny. Every time a website update goes up, you know, within minutes, people are talking on the forums about what that could mean and what message was implied there. And, you know, usually they're trying to find something in nothing.
I think you're right. Like, no matter what you do, you're probably going to offend someone. And I had one situation quite a while ago. I did an episode, a two-part series, actually. The first one was 5 reasons to not shop at your friendly local game store. And the second one was 5 reasons to shop there.
So yeah, I remember that.
Someone in my local gaming community, who goes to my friendly local game store decided that they were going to use that particular episode about why you should not as a reason in an internet message board discussion for why you should have no trouble going purchasing things online and then using them at your friendly local game store. So of course that exploded. And next thing I know, there's all these, I'm going to call them less than constructive comments on my blog and all over the place. And people I know are texting me and like, it became a beast overnight because I was like, well, let's give some examples of why you should. And like the examples I gave weren't like, cause you want to screw them over. It's with things like, oh, they don't have what you need or they're not friendly or maybe they're not actually nearby or, you know, like they're a really dirty place. Like, you know, like they have rat droppings everywhere or whatever. Those are reasons not to go there, right? Cause if they're not going to support what you're doing, if they don't care about proper hygiene or if they're mean to you, you shouldn't give them your business. But that's not how the beast came and the message got distorted. Just kind of, it can happen to anyone.
It can, and it does. And so, you know, I think to their credit, and I think sometimes WWPD suffers from this a bit too. It doesn't seem like recently. I think we've kind of crafted our message pretty well now. But if you come off as very professional, then people expect that from you. And a lot of times the truth is, you know, in this cottage industry with all these tools available, you know, at our disposal, thanks to the internet and things, a company can come off as more professional than maybe they are. And I don't mean that as a knock on Battlefront. What I mean is, you know, if I showed my wife these boxes of terrain, you know, before we moved there, or whatever, she'd probably think, oh, cool. Can you get this like at Walmart or something? It's like, well, no, there's actually not, it's not that big of an industry, you know, because it's so sleek and professional looking that they're held to a higher standard, just like GW. And, you know, I think GW is something in, you know, 10 times the size of Battlefront or something. So yeah, I mean, but the same with podcasts, right? If you have, I mean, I've had tons of people ask me, so what's it like being a podcaster for a living? I'm like, living?
For a living? What?
Right? What are you talking about? This is in my free time. This is my meta hobby. So, you know, and that's cool because we want to come off as looking professional and acting professional. But then sometimes you almost wish you could tell people, yeah, but we're really not as professional as we look, you know?
Well, I try to tell people, I'm like, you know what? I'm just a guy who speaks into a microphone, and it just so happens to be people listen.
Right.
You know, for whatever reason. But it's funny because when you come down to the finances of it, which a topic that I'm sure is boring for a lot of people, I don't know about you, but like I lose money, so to speak, on doing the whole show and everything because it costs money and I have a sponsor and they help, which is fantastic. But when you figure the money you got to spend to get stuff, to review, to go to conventions and then like prize support, like just to send out t-shirts. T-shirts aren't cheap. Postage isn't cheap.
That's right.
You know, these are things we do because we enjoy it. It's our hobby. It's the price of the game, right? But it doesn't mean that it puts money in our pocket. There's only two podcasters I've ever met virtually who've been able to make a living out of podcasting. One makes over 150K a year, and the other one, not as good, but does pretty well. But they don't live in the same type of environments we do. They live in a more Midwestern part of the U.S., and they also do it on a completely different type of topic. Like you said, it's a cottage industry. So if Battlefront is a small company and they have, you know, X number of customers, well, how many, quote, customers or listeners are someone like you and I going to have? It's a lot for us, but is it enough to sustain?
Sure. Yeah.
Is it enough to sustain you and all of the members of WWP? No,
yeah.
Of course not.
Not even close. And just to revisit that, you know, I say all these things because I'm playing devil's advocate on behalf of Battlefront, saying they basically don't have the staff, you know, or they do have the staff, but people are so busy that these things just kind of slip through the cracks. On the other hand, it's now happened enough that I think it's probably in their best interest to have someone dedicated to that. And I think that was me for a time, or was certainly becoming me. And they certainly have some people there who are very capable with those skills. The problem is, again, there's a lot of work to be done, you know, for a small amount of dudes, which, you know, I want to be careful that people aren't misinterpreting there that, you know, that there's any real issues there other than it's a small industry, smaller company than people probably think. And people just wear a lot of hats, right?
Yeah, definitely. When the original statement came out, I was disgusted by it. I was like, oh, how dare they? What are they thinking of? And then I sat on it for a bit. I was like, you know, they probably didn't mean it the way we're all taking it. And then like it exploded everywhere. And it's one of those things where things just get a nature of their own, whether it's intended or not. And it's just stuff comes alive.
Yeah, the trick is handling that on the back end. I mean, that's what PR is all about. And I do think that PR is something Battlefront could benefit from. And I think, you know, again, that's one of the roles I was going to take on. I just think managing people's expectations is really important, and then kind of managing the back end. Sometimes it's just a storm in a teacup, though. You know, I mean, it's what seems like the world is crashing on the forums. You realize, you know what, that's like 10 people, though. And there's literally tens of thousands of customers who probably didn't even read this. But, you know, just, you know, it's important to manage your image and manage your brand and to live by your brand values. And so that's harder to do if you don't have people who are sort of the stewards of your brand, you know, sort of in charge of keeping things, you know, moving the way you want them to, giving the message that you want to give them.
So when you were at Battlefront, for many a gamer, that would be like the dream job. What was it? You said that you would wear many hats, and of course it's difficult because it's a small company, but what was it like for you, like on an average day, working on your different projects and everything?
Sure. It was pretty interesting. I mean, a typical day was kind of hard to call. Thursdays there were the web update day. So those tend to be pretty busy as you pull all the articles together from all the writers and everything. And crazy shout out to Blake Coster, who works on that. He's just a machine. I mean, the man can just churn through some content and throw it up on the site in a very quick, turnaround with very high quality. So, mad props to him. He was the real workhorse on that. But, so that was a large part of my job, was managing, the website. And that was both for the Firefly game and Spartacus, which was not updated frequently. Thinking through getting the Dust website set up, so those types of things. So I was sort of the steward of those websites. And then internally, would have, you know, I'd have some random projects to work on. mostly around marketing and things like that. So all of the Facebook and the Twitter that came out of my time there are still going strong, and they're still using some of the same cool strategies. So that's interesting to see going on, which I think is the right move. So I did a lot of the social media stuff. I fielded quite a lot of customer service emails. I mean, those types of things.
So not too long ago, I made a big announcement that my wife and I are expecting.
That's right. Congratulations.
Why, thank you. So my next area I'd like to push you into is one that will be of quite a lot of interest to me as time moves forward. And I know it's one that's a lot of interest to a variety of listeners, both of my show and your show, and just historical wargamers in general. Why don't you talk about what it's like being a father and a wargamer? I've seen photos, for example, online of your daughter, and you've introduced her, I would say, very initially into different types of gaming, preliminary kind of stuff, monsters and buildings, tearing things down and that sort of stuff. But why don't you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. That's right. Yeah, so a lot of her introduction to gaming is her trying to grab things when she was younger. Now she's a little older, so she's not quite able to grasp the concept of a proper game. But we have played some zombie dice before. She doesn't really understand it, but she likes rolling dice.
It's a great game.
Yeah, it's cool. I've bought her a couple sets of dice that she really likes, and so if you ask her what Daddy's favorite game is, she'll say dice, because you know, that's kind of what she focuses on. But yeah, I mean, she's not quite old enough to where we've really started introducing her to gaming proper, but we're planning on it. We're always looking for games that are going to be fun for the family and kind of co-op level games, which I think has really spurred, you know, sort of my diversion into board games and things like that, which is pretty interesting. I'm really excited about that. Ultimately, though, you know, it's her choice. I mean, I don't want to like force her into gaming. If she gets to 7 or 8, or God forbid, probably 13, saying, you know what, I don't want to have anything to do with this, well, that's cool. You know, everyone needs to have their own hobbies. But the best part is I haven't really had to hit the brakes on my hobbying much. I mean, a lot of people, I think, do. And the crazy credit to that goes to my wife. And now, you know, in fairness, it's not because I'm, you know, not doing anything. It's just that Lydia and I really take each other's independence very seriously. So, you know, like if I want to go to Fall Inn, I'm going to go to Fall Inn. And then if she wants to go, like, visit some of her friends in Canada or something, she's going to do that. And so we really try to empower people. And we see a lot of marriages and not really any of our close friends, but, you know, kind of acquaintances where that really seems to be the opposite. It almost seems to be like people forget that the other person has things that they are interested in and want to do. And so I think that's really, I don't know, I guess I'm really appreciative of that and really thankful that we have that in our relationship. But ultimately what it means is if Isabel wants to game with me, I would be more than happy and would absolutely love to have her game with me. But if she also decides that, you know what, I'm really into, you know, bike riding or whatever, then I will foster that hobby and do whatever I can to make sure that she really enjoys that. And I won't, you know, push any of this on her. So I don't know, is that getting a little too high level there?
No. I think that's really, I've been, of course, on the lookout for ages for introductory kind of games. My wife is not what you would call a gamer. She likes, say, Mario Kart for video games or party type games. Apples to Apples would be probably her favorite, quote,
sure,
board game.
So, if you like that, you should go ahead and just introduce the kid to Cards Against Humanity. Two, three, whatever. That's age appropriate.
Well, it's funny because my wife had played that and she's like, you've never played Cards Against Humanity? I was like, no. So we were at one of her friend's birthday parties housewarming. So we're there and her friend's girlfriend was like, oh, who wants to play Cards Against Humanity? And so they've got it out and they introduced it and playing or whatever. But her friend's girlfriend, a bunch of her family had come, including some small children. So we're there.
Oh, no.
And we're playing as there's like a 4-year-old toddling around.
Yeah.
and so it's like the worst cards possible come up. But I mean, hilarious at the same time. And we were grateful that the kids couldn't quite grasp exactly what we were doing. They were just like, right, oh, grown-ups are playing.
They're playing poker or some card game.
Yeah.
That's silly.
I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the best part for me is that while my overall hobby time has diminished a bit, that's basically just cut into my painting time, which is fine because I have so much crap painted, so I can still pretty much play whatever. So I've basically just, I get less stuff painted now, but I'm still gaming pretty much as I ever was, which is fantastic.
See, that wouldn't impact me at all because I don't paint.
There you go. That's right. I know painting's a struggle for you.
Oh, that's a polite way to put it.
Well, great. You're good to go then.
I get more than my fair share of crap from people for not painting. And not that I'm advocating that people should never paint. Henry Hyde and I talked a little bit about it when I mentioned to him about an episode previously where I was like, oh, are painted miniatures essential to miniatures wargaming? And he surprised me because he agreed with me. He said, no, they are not essential. In my theory is your models still work whether they have paint on them or not. They might work better, you know, if you believe that, but you can still use them. Do they look better? Of course. And are there sometimes that you need to have them? If you're going to Fallen, you better have a painted army. I don't care, you know, how long it takes you. You got to have it.
Sure.
But like, he surprised me. He's like, well, in the right setting, if you're doing, you know, like a low tech kind of table and not all those fancy 3D built-ins and stuff, then yeah, it can look perfectly fine. It's like a classic toy soldier kind of feel.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm with you on that. Obviously, I'm a huge, you know, proponent of having painted miniatures, but I think that's, you touched that, right? If you go to an event, I really don't like seeing unpainted models. And I mean, as an example, we just went to Gen Con. And so you walk by the 40K, you walk by the, even the War Machine, and there's a handful of really beautiful painted models and then armfuls of just assembled, maybe primed models. And then you go by the Flames War Tournament and every single model is painted. And that's certainly one of the things that drew me to Flames War in the first place. And it also really drives, what WWPD does. Like, we will almost never put unpainted models in a battle report. And we have twice, and both times it kind of slipped by me. And I had a little bit of a Steve Jobs moment of saying, I will never see an unpainted model on a table on my site ever again. We're not going to do that again. You know, so, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree with you though, right? First of all, the biggest thing is gaming is whatever people want it to be. If you want to play with unpainted miniatures, I couldn't care one tiny iota. You know, do what you want at your house. But if I'm going to a tournament, you know, for Flames of War, I expect to play against a painted army. And I think that's fair, because otherwise just go play board games. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting because speaking of tourneys and running things at events, some buddies of mine and I, and we've got in the habit of running one or more events at TotalCon, which is a sci-fi board game RPG family-friendly convention in Massachusetts, southeastern Mass. And so we're like the only or one of the very, very few historical games that are there. But what always intrigued me was that they have a lot of historical wargamers who go to this, but they tend to go because they like to play other things. Mm-hmm. And yet they'll sign up for our events. And one of our rules is that we won't field anything on the table that's unpainted. It has to have a respective number of different colored paints. They don't, you know, we're not doing the GW, you need at least three colors of paints and shading, whatever, but it needs to have something.
Sure.
And obviously I'm not going to be the guy to do that, but I'm lucky enough that there's one individual who, he's fantastic at making terrain. He loves to paint. He gets it done. Another guy who's really good at painting, he gets that done. He'll devise the scenarios and come up with how we're going to work it. And then I handle all the PR. I work with the con. I get all that stuff. So we're each using our own strengths to kind of present this event and introduce more people potentially to the hobby and get people into it. And it seems to be working for us. Would it work if we didn't have all the painted models on the table? I would say no.
Right. But, like, that's one of the draws of it, I think. You know, that's what makes it so cool.
Well, the first time we ran one of our events, I was freaking out. I was like, oh, how are we going to know if people are going to even come? We're doing all this work and everything, and are we just going to take up space for the con? And one of my concerns is always, what is the other side going to get out of it? So, like, when I have you on the show, you don't have product to sell per se, but my hope is to drive more people to listen to you, to visit your blog and see all the stuff that you do. And at a place like TotalCon, my hope is to help to get more people to come and attend the con. So I was like, well, is anyone going to even come to the event? And after getting in touch with the head PR person there, she was like, you know, what we figured out for our minis events is that people tend to not pre-register for them. They will for like everything else, but they don't for minis because they want to come by and see how your table looks like.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
And I think that's the key. Like, but when you go to a historical wargaming convention, such as like you've gone Historicon and I've hit up Havoc and Huzzah, it's kind of a blend. People, at least with me anyway, I tend to look for certain systems and names. If I know a GM's really good, I'll play in their game. Like, there's a guy, Mike Payne. Anything that he runs, I will play in. I don't care what it is. We could be playing checkers. but he is just such a fantastic game master. I know I'm going to have a good time. And consequently, I'll look for certain systems, or maybe I'll avoid certain systems too. So I'm not doing so much of the, oh, does that table look really cool? But like, that'll really draw me in. But if the table's not good, if you don't have paint on your models and your terrain looks like crap, you might not get people to play in your event. It's just how it kind of goes.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're absolutely right. And I think the other side is, you know, the people come from a diverse background into historical miniature gaming, and people really like different aspects of it. I mean, lots of people really like the painting, and maybe for them that's the most important part. Maybe that's 60% of it. You know, plenty of people like the actual gaming, and they get really competitive about the gaming. I mean, I can name people, you know, off the top of my head who I think kind of fit these archetypes. I mean, Eric Riha is, you know, fantastic, very competitive, very intelligent when it comes to the math side of things. Never gets his armies painted on time, and I'm calling you out if you listen to that, Riha. On the other side, you've got like John. You know, John, and I think I'm a little more into this camp. We'll paint anything just to paint it, just because it'll be fun. And we approach the game a bit more casually, although not so much. I mean, we're kind of, I think maybe 50-50. But then you have people who just want to paint armies, and they really couldn't care less about actually even playing the game. And then you have people who are really into list building, and I think Luke falls into that. Like, he's always looking for the best combinations in his army list and stuff, whereas I'm like, I just kind of want to, you know, I want to play a good list that fits me, right? But I don't stress over, you know, what am I going to do with these 15, 20 points? And honestly, you know, list building isn't what excites me. So, you know, there's so many different facets, and people can really focus on each one of those. And sometimes people can kind of forget, I guess, that it takes all kinds. I mean, if you play with someone who's ultra competitive and they're calling out every single rule or something, and that's not the style you want to play, you know, it's like, well, you need to kind of lay off here a little bit, you know, or vice versa. If someone's calling out like, well, you know, in 1944, they weren't wearing that color camo smock or whatever. And you're like, yeah, I don't care, you know. So I think it's important for people to remember that it really takes all kinds, and that's, you know, half the fun. And it's something we really try to remember at WWPD also. I mean, when we post articles, we really try to remember, well, you know, we haven't really posted a meaty painting article lately, or a tutorial for beginners, or something really complex for, you know, high level tournament gamers. Like, we really try to run the gamut, and hit kind of all those interests when we can.
One of my general mottos when it comes to wargaming is that I will play just about anything as long as I, one, don't have to paint anything, and two, don't have to assemble anything. I don't mind if I have to buy stuff, but if someone else is going to do that, you'll get me to play Tiddlywinks, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. But once I have to start doing one of those two things, that's when I start really thinking, do I really want to do this? Is it, yeah, gonna, you know, be, cause those are the things that force you to invest so much time, which I think, time's hard. Like, as we are older now than we were when we were like in college and everything, we don't have as much of that time. And like, you have a kid, your kid takes a lot of time.
Yep, that's absolutely right. And it's why I was very initially against a lot of the new plastics that were coming out. I think all the producers of plastics have kind of heard that now, and I think assembly's gotten much easier. But yeah, assembling, I love painting. I hate assembling stuff. Hate it. I will buy something if it's more expensive, but in three pieces, than a cheaper version that's in 10. Like, I don't care. I want to glue for 5 minutes and be done, and that's it. And I don't even really want to do that. So I'm with you on that.
Well, like, some of those, and not to point names at anyone, but some of those Plastic Soldier Company kits, they're a little too multi-part, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I just have bad memories of Games Workshop, for example, and needing to do, say, like 9, 10, 12, 15 pieces for one guy. I mean, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, that was ugly. Yeah, but I do think that we're not alone in that. And I think, you know, model painters, like guys who really go to town on, like, say, 1/35th scale, I think are a whole different breed. And I think that initial offerings for 15mm plastics and wargaming plastics, I think, kind of misinterpreted that, and so they kind of went for that. And I think the market now has really reacted to be, I mean, all the new Plastic Soldier Company stuff, all the new Battlefront stuff, I'm assembling some Minirons, T-26s right now for a review, they've all gotten it down. And I really think we're kind of in a golden age now of plastics that have come a long way. 3 or 4 years ago, I was thinking, yeah, I'm not so sure about this whole plastic thing. Now I'm thinking, oh yeah, this is it. Plastics are here to stay, and they're awesome.
I really wanted to get into Ancients using the Hail Caesar rules. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, I don't want to spend an arm and a leg on metals for this. And I don't want something that's going to be a million pieces to assemble. Someone was like, well, you should look into the hat industry, 20mm, 1/72nd scale. And I was like, okay, but they're plastics, right? And they're like, yeah, don't worry, you'll like them. Of course, I didn't believe when I was told that. And I went to a nearby historical wargaming shop, and I had to open the box and look, and I was like, oh, do you know what? Everything's there. There's nothing to assemble. And it turns out it's not quite that easy for some of the stuff. Like, you might have to put a shield on or a weapon. And did I look at that and go, oh, no, of course. But in the scheme of things, that's nothing. That's easy as pie.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's important. And I think, like you said, right, it's time. When people buy a product, they're not just paying you money, right? They're needing time to get that onto the table. And I think that's one of the geniuses of Battlefront when they really kind of went to the forefront of miniature gaming back in the days. I really think just having it all packaged for you and knowing exactly what you need, you know, that's an Apple level strategy. You know what I mean? You don't have to put too much time into it. And I feel like other companies still, and previously, partially because it's a cottage industry, you know, put a lot of extra work on you. I mean, you've got to figure out exactly, you know, what, oh, I need some tank commanders as well, so I need to buy that separately. And oh, I need 50 cals, but I need 10, so let me order two of that pack. You know, I think that's important. It's got to be low cost of entry, and not just monetarily. It's got to be people's time, people's money. Because especially as time goes on, you're competing with more and more easy things to distract you. I mean, how many video games do you own? I own a ton. How many board games now do I own? Where a board game, you crack it open and play. I mean, you're playing within 10 minutes. You know, miniatures is such a high cost of entry for players and such a low cost of entry for manufacturers that it's just a really kind of funky, kind of weird industry, right? It's a cottage industry. I could go right now. I mean, I have no skill at this, but I could sculpt something. I could buy the parts to make a mold, and I could go on the miniatures page and start selling it right now. But I couldn't do that really with a video game. Not really. It would take me a lot more time and expertise. You know what I'm saying? It's like it causes a very strange industry. And I think that's one thing that companies really need to keep in mind is they really have to do everything they can to get this cost of entry down. And you can look at the people who are successful with it, right? Fantasy Flight, what is it that they're doing right now? Pre-painted Star Wars ships. Do you know how much money they're making off that? How people are just eating it up because it's awesome. I mean, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of X-Wing anymore, but at the end of the day, it's genius. That's what wargaming really needed. I mean, and you can argue whether that's a wargame or a board game, but the bottom line is you're playing with miniatures that are painted, you know?
I think there's also that there's a disparity between historical wargaming and non-historical wargaming. When I first took the leap into historical wargaming, I came from that GW Battlefront metric where everything is there. Everything you need from dice on down is made by them. Their magazines and their e-content tell you this is a color you can use for this if you want to achieve that. And like they walk you through everything and they're the ones who make the models and the stuff for their whatever. But if you jump into historical wargaming, like the mainstream historical wargaming, you have no net, you have no guide. So I was like, I'm going to do Black Powder, and I want to get in, and I want to do American War of Independence. And I was like, okay, well, how do I do that? I get the book, but like, where do I go to get the models and this and that? And like, I freaked out. And I've said throughout the ages, if it weren't for Henry Hyde, who very kindly took a very lengthy email of mine, took the time out of his busy schedule as a magazine editor, and answered my questions and was like, okay, this is what you do. We wouldn't be talking now is what it is. And I wouldn't be playing the games that I play, but that cost of entry is huge. It's phenomenal. And it doesn't need to be like that. There's too much freedom. It's kind of like if you're looking at tech and you have Apple where it's there for you, right? Or if you want to buy a new cell phone, you're like, I don't know if I want the iPhone and you want a Droid. Well, what Droid do you want? It depends is the answer, but there's no real how to make that choice for yourself.
Sure, right. I mean, sometimes too much choice makes people kind of freeze up. I mean, sometimes you want to feel like you have choices, but not that many choices. You know, no one will admit that. I mean, if you ask anyone on the street, hey, would you rather have ultimate freedom of choice or a couple of good choices that were kind of pre-done for you? Everyone's going to say, oh, I want full choice. But the reality is, you know, when people are faced with a couple of choices for something they're interested in, it's actually makes it easier on them. And I'm sure there's people smarter than I have who have done studies on that because I know I've read something along those lines. But yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. We're a hard industry. We're a strange industry because it's got this, it's sort of the opposite of like computer games. It's got this low cost of entry for manufacturers, which makes for phenomenal competition, which is good for consumers, obviously. But then you've also got this really high cost of entry for the consumers, both in monetary investments and in time. So yeah, it's a strange industry, and it's, you know, it's kind of kooky, and I love it. But I will say that I'm fairly glad to be out of it as a real professional. You know, I'm now back to being a meta professional.
So we talked a little bit about cons, and way back on your first appearance on the show, you had just come back from Cold Wars in 2011, and, mm-hmm. and you referred to your time at Cold Wars as a drunken coma. So, like, in my experience, in my limited experience at conventions, I've covered TotalCon, for example, and I talk a lot about TotalCon just because I love it, and they've been really, really good to me. So, like, I went to TotalCon 2013, and I recorded, like, this three-hour thing in my hotel room, half of which I was, let's just say, less than sober for. And then last year, 2014, I went to all these after parties that had all these industry guests there and con organizers and stuff, and I got to, you know, hang out with people from TSR who worked with, like, Gary Gygax and everything. And let's just say...
Cool.
Like, the alcohol flowed, and I'm not allowed to say a whole lot about what happened at these things, but they were fuzzy weekends. So would you say that your quote-unquote drunken coma from Cold Wars 2011 is kind of a philosophy that you like to carry through on cons? Like, how does that change? Like, how does that impact, like, your live shows? Because your live shows are a huge portion of what you do.
Right. I mean, 2011 was certainly the pinnacle, and there's recorded evidence of that. it's not a drunken stupor for me anymore. And part of that is because, you know, we kind of have work to do. I mean, on Saturday, the day of the live show, I can't really commit to anything because it takes a lot of preparation for what we do for that. So, I don't really do it much. I mean, I certainly, you know, enjoy a couple beers, couple brews with some friends. But no, that's not really a goal of mine. I mean, it happened in 2011, and I think it was all the excitement and the hype of doing a live show and having a really good time. But, I've settled into something a little bit more, repeatable, a little less, you know, off the rails. So, I mean, but I think whether it's, you know, the drink or not, it's, you know, it's all about having a really good time socializing with people who are, you know, in the same mindset as you, which is something that's pretty rare for gamers, really. I mean, at that scale. And so, you know, I think it's, yeah, you know, you show up, you party, you have a couple drinks, just like humans have done forever. But these are these, you know, real havens for us because, you know, it's pretty rare that you can talk all day about the tenets of, you know, a new rule set and not have people look at you like you're bizarre, you know? I think that's just the two go hand in hand, right? It's the social lubricant. People have a great time. And, God, I would hate it if alcohol were taken out of conventions. And that makes me sound like a drunk, but really I keep it in check. I keep it in check since 2011.
Well, like TotalCon, for example, it's a family friendly convention. So there's no alcohol allowed on the floor. Now, right. Is that to say some people don't abide by that? They probably don't. Are they caught? I would hope so. But it happens behind the scenes. And like other conventions, like I go to Havoc, which is the oldest historical wargaming convention in all of New England. You play and you're drinking right there in the hall. And at Huzzah up in Maine, you go, you get your beer or whatever you want to drink, and you just walk over to your gaming table and there you go in. And it's not the focus of it. But like you said, it's part of the experience. I've always remarked about going to conventions as I go when I have fun, but I'm not going there just as an attendee. I go there to work the convention so I can get material for the show. And I can't be talking with whoever about such and such or being able to remember what happened if I'm spending all my time having like 40 drinks in a day or anything. It's not going to work.
And my memory is already bad. So like I'm so bad with names. You know, every year I see people, I recognize them. I remember conversations we've had, but I can't remember people's names. And the maybe 10 or 15% that I do remember would certainly be diminished to about 2 or 3% if I drank any more at those conventions. So, I do it for the fans. I stay sober for the fans, really.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. This is going to really sound conceited, and I don't mean it in this way at all, but we're lucky enough that we've had some sort of communities that have grown up around our respective shows. And WWPD has done a phenomenal job of picking the right places to be and helping communities to nurture some that have already been there and new ones to form. So when you go to something public, whether you're just going to your local game store or you're going to one of these big historical conventions or whatever, and you're working it, you have this community that you're there for. You are, in essence, whether it's official or unofficial, but you're a very important person there. You're one of the stars, so to speak. This is where it sounds conceited, because I hate to be like, well, I'm a star. But when I went
We're big fish in a very, very tiny mud puddle, right?
Oh, I'm not even sure. I'm a minuscule fish in a tiny mud puddle.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, there are times when you can't walk from one end of the hall to the bathroom without, you know, having a bunch of people stop and chat you up. You know, the difference is it's not a celebrity type thing. Like, you can understand, like, yeah, this is weird to talk about too. I don't want to come off as conceited, but you can understand how maybe someone who's actually famous feels like when they go out in public. Like, you know, if Tom Cruise goes out in public, I bet it's just awful for him. It's not awful for us, because it's all people who we kind of know, right? It's the same faces we know. We've had conversations just about everybody. But it's funny. One time we were talking about that, we were like, man, you know, it's really cool, like, seeing all these people, but sometimes I just need to go take a leak. But you'll have, you know, a bunch of people want to stop and chat, which, again, that's really cool. And we're incredibly excited about that. But yeah, it is kind of funny to, I don't know, I guess be people who are recognized at those conventions, which it was great being at Gen Con. Nobody recognized us except for one time John and I were walking and some dudes, you know, came up to us, and I'm sorry, I can't remember their names, but they're like, oh, it's crazy seeing you guys here. You know, we're big fans of the show. It's like, holy crap, where did you guys come from? That was crazy. But, you know, but like HMGS and stuff. Yeah, we know a lot of people there. So, it's really interesting. I don't know. It's kind of bizarre, really. My wife remarked about how funny it was, because she came and, you know, we walked around the dealer hall for a while, and how many people stopped and chatted. She's like, so are you like a big deal? It's like, well, no. I mean, this is a, you know, very, very tiny industry, but sure, for today, sure, I'll be a big deal today.
Well, I remember the first time I met a listener who wasn't someone I had previously known, and they come up to me, his name's Patrick, it comes up to me at TotalCon, as it was a few years back, and he's like, hi, are you Jonathan? And I was like, yeah. I was like, how do I know you? Did I like run over your cat or what did I do? Did I do something? Cause my instinct is always, I must have done something wrong. Like, how did I wrong you? Let me make it better. And he's like, oh, I listened to your show. I was like, wait, what show? You listen to me? And
what's your problem? Right?
Like, why? Don't you have something better to do? But then I realize how insulting that sounds, but I'm just so incredulous, because, you know, we're not famous. We're not anything. We happen to talk and people listen. So the fact that people do listen, it always, I'm grateful, but it amazes me. It's like, wait, you take time out of your life to listen? Like, wow.
Yeah,
that's
the
incredible.
Same way. And sometimes there's even a tiny little twinge of guilt, because I'm like, man, you know, these people really enjoy our show. And there are days when I'm like, oh God, I got to go record the podcast. I forgot. It's tonight.
I have a lot of those.
I haven't even looked at the show notes. Let me go get prepared and do this crap. And then people come up like, guys, you've really like reinvigorated my gaming, you know, our game group. And it's like, wow, I feel a little guilty about those days when I like didn't really want to do it. You know?
Well, do you know what? I know we're getting near the end of the episode, but I'd want to touch on one thing you said way back that was your WWPD motto. And I think it's similar, I think, to what I've had in my head all along for myself. But I think it's a very, very important one. You said that, quote, you wanted WWPD to be, quote, be for the gamers instead of for the corporations, unquote. And on your website, in your product review section, you have a policy that says, quote, the independent integrity of WWPD is very important to us. We work hard to maintain our reputation as an honest and independent source of information about our hobbies, unquote. So it's clear that's important to you, and that you espouse that in as many ways as possible. Why do you feel it's so important? I know why I would feel that, and maybe this seems like a dumb question, but just a chance for you to kind of shine.
Sure. I mean, I guess, you know, ever since we started, we wanted to be a community for gamers, and you can't be a genuine, you know, community of consumers if you aren't also a consumer and representing their interests. I mean, it's the difference between grassroots and astroturfing. And there's certainly been some gray lines. You know, there's been some blurry lines because it's such a small industry that we know everyone. We know people by name. I mean, we're advertising War Games of Soldiers and Strategy on our website. We're talking about how good the magazine is. And I'm also comfortable enough with Jasper to joke about how the sheep in his country are terrible. They're just dreadful. So there's certainly some, you know, so sometimes we have to step back and we're very caught. We have a lot of internal discussions of saying, hey, listen, you know, is this really what you thought about this review? Are you padding it? Are you being a little nicer because, you know, they worked on it? And it's really something that we take quite seriously. And there have been times when we've gotten something that we didn't like at all. And that is in our policy as well. If there's something that we really just don't want to say terrible things about, that goes directly against our other policy of really trying to be positive. And so there have been things that we have not reviewed because we didn't like them at all. Like they would have been the worst reviews. So if you go back and look through our reviews, they tend to be, you know, medium to good. You'll never see just an awful or rarely see just an awful review of ours unless we really feel comfortable doing that. And that's one of those things that we constantly have to be very introspective about of saying, you know, we don't want to lose credibility. We do want to, you know, be an advocate for consumers. And we also want to make sure that our friends who work in these games companies aren't going to be, you know, totally up in arms and feel really hurt by all the hard work they put into it, which, you know, is legitimate passion. So it's a constant tightrope. I mean, it's a constant struggle to maintain that balance. And I think we've done a pretty good job of it. And that's not to say we haven't slipped now and again. Maybe we've criticized something a little too harshly that didn't deserve it, or that we've given something a pass that really shouldn't have gotten a pass from us. But it is something we take very seriously, and we really try to be very self-analytical about that. I guess, you know, that remains up to the fans, and I'm sure there's people out there who feel like we've done a terrible job and that we are, you know, the marketing team for Battlefront. And that can be hard to come by, because the other thing is, you know, we don't do this for a job. We do this because we like what we do. And so you're not going to get a whole lot of negativity from us, because otherwise we wouldn't do it at all. I mean, if I hated Flames of War, guess what I would not be doing? Recording a podcast every other week and writing 3 articles a week about it. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, it's a real tightrope walk. But most importantly is we try to just be really upfront about that. And that's why that review policy is there. We want people to know, you know, we really, really try to be, neutral about this. But one of the things we're not going to do is if Battlefront comes out with a new model, we're not going to go buy every manufacturer's model to compare it. That's not something we're going to do. Other websites have done that, and it's fantastic, and those are great resources, but that's not something that we're ever going to do, because it's not what we want to do. You know, we don't want to have to go buy a million different things and compare them all together. So we have some kind of pretty clear guidelines on how we write articles and how we review things, and then sometimes we just have to take it, you know, kind of at a fingertip feeling and decide, you know, decide how we're going to proceed with that. I don't know. I guess we'll leave it to the community to be our ultimate judge there to see if we're holding up to our promise. But I feel pretty good about what we've done so far. And there's, you know, certainly been a few missteps. But as we were talking about earlier, considering this is just a meta hobby for us and not even a real job, I feel pretty confident. I feel like I can sleep at night for the work that we've done.
Well, you know, there are entities that exist solely to do reviews. And if you want it to be a consumer reports, people can do that. But that's not for everyone, and that's okay. But I think also silence can speak volumes. I've always said that I won't have anyone on my shows that I don't like. I won't talk about anything that I don't like. And if I'm not talking about something, maybe there's a reason behind it. There have been times where there have been companies and entities that I've thought about talking about, but realized I would have nothing positive to say. And right. Rather than just speak negativity, there's no value in that. So why just take up airtime to be like,
sure,
this is awful, this is bad, or what? No one needs that. No one wants to hear that. So,
well,
I think
more specifically that there can be value in that if that's what you do, right? If you're all about being, like you said, the consumer reports. Sure. But it's not something that we want to do because we have to be motivated to do what we do because, you know, we're not doing this for a living again. So yeah, but I'm with you 100%. Like it's got to be something we're at least interested in. You know, whether the end result is that we don't like it or, you know, we try to be positive about things. But yeah, that's the way we're going to continue to approach product reviews. And the truth is, you know, and it's just the nature of the beast. the products that we love, those companies want us to continue loving, you know, reviewing their products. And so once we've done our 15th Plastic Soldier Company review, we're thinking, gosh, is there anything bad we can say about this just to balance it out? But, you know, a lot of times there's not. And you can't just say something for the sake of saying it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, so it can be a long discussion, an internal discussion about, you know, how to approach a particular topic or not. But like, you know, I mean, a good example is like the new Battlefront book that came out, the Bridget Remagen book. We reviewed that and we're basically gushing about it. And we're thinking, gosh, you know, do we really need to rein this in any ways? I mean, we really, really like this book. It's really cool. And we decided not to. And I think we weren't lying. I mean, we weren't doing that because we like Battlefront. We loved it. We've all been playing lists out of that book lately. You know, I just ran a tournament with those lists. Like, that's because we would much rather be genuine, you know, and let our genuine excitement show through. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm getting to rant level now, but this is something that's constantly on my mind and it's something I'm constantly trying to keep in check.
So before I move into the mailbag section of the show, which is something that happens near the end of an episode, why don't I give you the opportunity to tell listeners how they can keep up to date with all the stuff that you do over at Battlefront, your social media addresses, the website addresses, and podcast schedule and all that kind of stuff.
All right, there's a lot, so let me see if I can go through it all in my head as quickly as possible. Okay. The main site is WWPD.net. That's the Flames of War site. We've also got BoltAction.net, which is all about Warlord Games Bolt Action. We've got Saga Tapestry, which is all about the Saga by Studio Tomahawk. And then we've also got Outpost Zero, which is getting a lot more attention from us internally now. That's all about everything else, basically. Board games, some video games in there, card games, things like that. I've been devoting a lot of time to that website, trying to bolster it up because it's something I'd like to really see WWPD expand into in the next couple of years. We've also got a rockin' forum where I really think they're among the best communities on the web. People are really helpful there, really friendly. And that is forum.wwpd.net. We are also on Facebook as WWPD and boltaction.net. We're on Twitter as WWPD Podcast. I am on Twitter at SJ McLaughlin. That's MacLachlan. I think that about covers it.
And lyrical, too.
That's right. It's like the Mickey Mouse song. That's how my wife learned how to spell it.
Well, you know, it goes back to your roots as a musician.
That's right. There you go.
Never, ever ask me to sing. Not that you would, but trust me, you don't want to.
Oh, me and Isabel were playing guitar and singing earlier. It's good fun.
I bet she sings 100 times better than I ever could.
She's getting pretty good. She's getting good.
So let's just dive into mailbag. And if you got a few moments and you want to stick around.
You got it. Let's do it.
Okay, so every episode I like to do mailbag because I love to hear from listeners like each and every single one of you. And interacting with all of you is my favorite part of podcasting, whether it's in person at a game day or at a convention or via email and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. I just love to hear from you and love to chat and see what's going on in each and all of your lives. So we've had a lot of activity lately on Facebook, and Facebook has been exploding for us. More and more of you have been liking our Facebook page, and I want to thank you for that. But I want to share some comments that those of you have shared with us. So I want to start off with listener David. He happened to comment on a photo that we put up of a bunch of kids playing with 54mm All the King's Men models. I believe they were playing American Rev, and he says, quote, 54mm is a great scale, big battles for small hands. I know for a fact that David uses 54mm to get the young ones in his life into some gaming and give them the chance to, you know, really get their mitts around something. And I've found, just in my own experience, that 54mm really appeals to kids because it's not a whole lot smaller than what they are, and they can grab onto it and be like, hey, look, this looks like a real person. So I just wanted to thank David for coming in. And it feels like 54mm is a scale that's kind of getting more attention these days than it used to.
Yeah, I saw someone at all the HMGS conventions is now doing a Flames of War table in 54mm, and it looks awesome. I really need to play on that. Yeah, it looks cool. And our friends, the Lehman Brothers, they're actually father and son team, but we like to say that Germany's declared war on the Lehman Brothers. They do some 54mm Napoleonics that look absolutely stunning. So yeah, it's a cool skill. I've never ever played a single game of 54mm, but it certainly looks awesome.
I can't say enough nice things about 54mm musket and tomahawk. It's a great game to play in that kind of scale. Anything skirmish, I think, just works well with it.
No, yeah, I can see that. That's cool.
We also had listener Jay remark about a photo of 25mm Old Glory Prussian hussars saying, quote, clad in the purest Shimmering Samite. There is some joking going on online about that being a Jonathan Reinhart paint job, as people know.
Right.
I was like, you know, it's really hard to get metallics to look so good like that. But, you know, it's interesting when you post photos of stuff, the instinct is to post a photo of something painted that looks awesome. But then there's also the value, which I've just more recently discovered, of the unpainted stuff to admire the sculpting that goes into it. There's a lot of skill in that.
Sure. And I guess in WSS, they do a lot of showing off the bare metal that's been dipped or ink just to settle into the recesses, because lighting tends to make bare metal lose its detail that you don't get in person. So and certainly a lot of manufacturers do that now as well. So that is a cool way to see exactly what the sculpt looks like without being distracted by the paint job.
That's one thing I noticed Battle Games Magazine used to do, and it seems that it's continued on in the new incarnation of miniature war games with battle games. And I enjoy that. At first I was like, why does it look a little black? But not quite. And then, you know, I caught on. I was like, oh, this is really neat. You can actually see all the details in it.
Yeah, it's a pretty genius approach.
And then also, listener Adrian, who is a buddy of mine, he happened to remark of some 54mm armies in plastic. He said, quote, in spite of some of the awkward poses, the AIP figures paint up very nicely. He said that they are exactly the same, regardless of the set you get. Still an inexpensive entry into 54mm, and I can attest to the fact that if you were to buy a box of armies in plastic, let's just pretend you're doing Rev War, and you're doing Continental Infantry, and you decide you want some red coats, they're the exact same models. One's going to be in blue plastic and one's going to be in red plastic.
Nice. That's pretty good.
It's great for someone like me because I like to joke, they come pre-painted. I mean, not really, but it's like the old days of doing like Little Wars, and you have your red army and your blue army, and off you go.
All you need is a rubber band gun and you're done.
Exactly. And then we had, this is a listener who I'm sure is listening to this episode because he's a huge fan of Flames of War, and he's actually looking to get into bolt action, I believe, to get his kids into it. Listener Carrie happened to comment on a photo of cornfields I posted from the Huzzah, from, that is completely wrong and false on my part, from the Hobby Bunker 2014 Game Day, saying, quote, I'd have to agree, pretty creative terrain. Awesome. These, if you guys haven't seen them yet, there'll be a link in the show notes, but these are the best looking cornfields I've ever seen in my life. And whenever I see cornfields on the tabletop, I instantly think of Wizard of Oz when Dorothy's hanging out with the Scarecrow and they're just right in all those cornfields.
Yeah. I'm looking at those now. Those do look really good.
I can't explain it. Wizard of Oz gets a lot of weird rap from adults. It's like, oh, you know, if you watch it under certain circumstances of things being imbibed or smoked, then you get a different experience. And not that I'm advocating any of that, but...
I wouldn't know on that one, but I'll take your word for it.
For some reason, these stupid, stupid cornfields, they always come up in my mind. I'm like, why is the Wizard of Oz on the table when there's a bunch of, you know, some... war stuff going on in there. It doesn't make any sense.
You know, you can get some flying monkeys from Alien Dungeon.
You can. They look good, too.
Yeah, they're cool.
And then finally, Superstar Game Master Mike gave some really high praise for the show. I have to say, first of all, that I am very appreciative of it. Do my best to try to live up to it, but he says, quote, these episodes are the best thing next to playing. He said, you earn the praise with every episode. Nobody else covers our local hobby like you do. Mike, that's some high praise indeed, and I hope to someday be eventually worthwhile of your praise. But it's just, you know, we don't do this for the praise. We do it because we have fun.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's rewarding. Although, you know, it's always nice to hear from people. I mean, that's one of the big things we get is, you know, people listen because they may not be able to make it out to their own game group or whatever. And so they feel like they're kind of... have a surrogate game group when they listen to us and hear us, you know, kind of ribbing each other and stuff. So, yeah, that's a really cool, I think, that's a really great compliment to get.
So one of the things I've been trying to do with Facebook is to have content that gets themed. So I'm finishing up the coverage of the Hobby Bunker 2014 Game Day. And in the coming weeks, there will be a focus on Flames of War and World War II content in honor of you, Steven. And then War Games, Soldiers and Strategy content / American Revolution in honor of Jasper Ortiz will be coming on down the pike. And speaking of which, I want to let everyone know about some upcoming guests. The next episode, we'll have Jasper Ortiz. He's going to come back to the show, and he's going to discuss the results of the Great Wargaming Survey. That'll be episode 123. And then frequent guest, Aaron Boston, he's going to be back for his, like, I don't know, 20th time on my show. And he's going to talk about with me the holiday gift guide that's going to come out November 24th. We'll share our top picks for the holiday purchasing, whether for yourself or for the non-gamers in your life. You have to buy something for you. So it'll be a lot of fun to do that. And then, of course, over the years, I've been very lucky to have a variety of guests on the show, and I really want to know who each of you would like to have on the show. If you have any sort of contact information or you can do an introduction for me, that would be great, because then I will reach out to people and get some more people on the show for you to listen to. Naturally, we have our episode guide. You can go and find all of the upcoming episodes, themes, who's going to be on, who's who, what's what, all that kind of stuff. And then don't forget, if you like what we do here at Wargaming Recon, I would really appreciate if you take the time to leave a review and rating on iTunes. Hopefully you listen and subscribe via iTunes, but if you don't, I would still suggest you take a moment to go on there. And well, why, right? Why should you take time out of your busy schedule to go into iTunes and click here and write something about the show? Well, iTunes is the number one podcast directory in the world. You want to find a show, that's where you go. And if you happen to find a show that has some cool reviews on there from people, you're likely to give it a chance. So by you leaving a review for the show, not only are you helping to grow the hobby, helping to get other potential listeners to come in and listen to the show and play games, maybe play games near you, but you can also get your name on the air. So what I will do is, through the magic of the internet, I can find out who left reviews and what you had to say. So for example, I can tell you that Steve B. from Canada left a 4-star review titled, "Great Stuff!" In their review, they said, "A great podcast full of a variety of good quality information." So I get to say thank you very much, Steve B. And if you were to leave a review, I can thank you as well. And I would be more than delighted to do so. Don't forget, you can always get in touch. We have a variety of ways, Facebook, email, Twitter. But all of that's in the show notes. And if you forget everything else in this episode, don't worry. Remember this one web address. It's wargamingforums.com/WR122. That's wargamingforums.com/WR122. The next episode of the show comes out on September 29, 2014, in which Jasper Ortiz and the Great Wargaming Survey make an appearance. Steven, I have been more than excited to have you on the show, and I got to get you back on here. And none of this waiting, you know, how many years it's been in between episodes.
Yeah, man, I'm happy to do it. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been a pleasure. So, as always, everyone knows the deal. Don't forget to check out all of Steven's stuff and find out what's going on at WWPD, Bolt Action, Saga Tapestry, and Outpost Zero. We'll have links to all of that in the show. And until next time, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter how many people are coming over, no matter how many Drunkmageddons you have going on, you have to keep on gaming. That's a wrap.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Thank you so much. I hope I didn't keep you too late.
Nah, no problem at all. Yeah, I'll talk to you on Facebook, man.
That sounds good. Have a good evening.
All right, dude. Have a good evening.
All right, bye. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Cast, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Geeks Explicitly, new episodes coming at you every Thursday, talking about geek life. If you don't listen to Geeks Explicitly, then... only at trollitc.com.
This is Andreas, apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com.